or entire meals would be processed and stored away for some future crisis that lived only in Ruby's imagination. She even experimented with freeze-drying greens, grinding them into a powder that could be reconstituted later. For all its grandeur, the house felt oddly sterile. Spacious, yet confining, modern, yet soulless. A house built for show, not for living. Ruby's obsession with camera-friendly minimalism meant our walls remained bare, save for the occasional picture. The lighting in our house was clinical, rows of bright white studio lights instead of warm, homey fixtures. It made everything look clean and pristine, but it lacked warmth. Like everything else in our lives, it was designed for the camera, not for comfort. We weren't even allowed to decorate our rooms or put up posters. Ruby feared tape would rip the paint or nails would damage the walls. The whole place felt more like a showroom than a home. Perched on the upper floor, my bedroom overlooked the backyard, a slice of nature framed by two windows. From my vantage point, the view was a tapestry of green. Dense box elder trees lined the creek at the bottom of the garden, their leaves rustling in the breeze, creating a natural curtain that partially obscured the fields beyond. On clear days, I could just make out the neighbor's horses grazing in the distance. For months after we moved in, I slept on a mattress on the floor, topped with a comforter that I struggle to remember clearly now. I think it was striped blue and white, but the details have faded with time. It's funny how such a central part of my daily life could have become so hazy in my memory. And to be honest, I didn't love having my own bedroom. I missed sharing with my youngest sister, whose bubbly energy had always helped take me out of my dark thoughts. At night, I'd often leave my windows open, letting the gentle murmur of the creek wash over me. The soothing sounds of rustling leaves and trickling water gradually eased my restless mind into sleep. Come morning, I'd wake with itchy eyes and a stuffy nose, courtesy of the box elders in the yard. But I welcomed these minor discomforts. In this house, a monument to artificial perfection, nature provided my only taste of authenticity and warmth. Those open windows became my lifeline, a portal to a world that still felt real and alive, unlike the sterile emptiness that surrounded me indoors. On March 3rd, 2020, my 17th birthday, Ruby finally allowed me to paint my bedroom wall. I chose a geometric blue-green triangle pattern, a small rebellion against the stark whiteness that dominated our home. It felt like a breath of fresh air, a tiny slice of personal expression in our tightly controlled world. But the respite was short-lived. Just 10 days later, the world ground to a halt as COVID-19 swept across the nation. If life felt suffocating before, it was about to become truly unbearable. As the pandemic took hold, Ruby continued posting to 8 passengers, but her demeanor had shifted. The channel she'd painstakingly built from the ground up now seemed to hold less allure for her than Jody's Connections venture. "This is going to be big," Ruby would say about Connections, with the same fervor she once reserved for our YouTube channel. "Jody is changing lives. She's changing me." It was true. She had changed. The yelling had stopped. She seemed calmer, more in control. She no longer flew off the handle at minor infractions or disagreements. But something else had taken its place. Something worse. Ruby's punishments became more psychological in nature, more focused on our emotions and minds than our bodies. Punishments themselves took on a more elaborate, almost theatrical quality. Instead of swift, straightforward consequences, a flick in the lips, a slap on the cheek, Ruby began devising complex object lessons meant to teach us about empathy, responsibility, or whatever virtue she felt we were lacking. These often involved grand gestures or prolonged periods of deprivation, all designed to make us truly feel the weight of our transgressions. May 2020, in a video titled "What We Haven't Told You," Chad dropped a bomb that would soon detonate our family's carefully curated image. He mentioned casually that he'd been sleeping on a beanbag on the basement floor for 7 whole months. On Jody's advice, Ruby removed Chad's bedroom privileges as punishment for continued defiance. His options? A pull-out guest bed, an inflatable mattress, or wherever. That wherever became a beanbag in the basement. 7 months. 210 nights on a beanbag. Ruby saw nothing unusual about this. Chad acted like he didn't care. It was a masterclass in emotional suppression, a skill we'd all been forced to perfect. When he let slip during filming what his current sleeping arrangements were, he did it so coolly, I doubt Ruby really even noticed. But Ruby's new editor did, and he made Chad's revelation the focus of the video, misguidedly thinking it would be interesting content. Ruby didn't hesitate to post it. Why would she? Jody had been pumping her full of misplaced confidence, convincing her that her unique parenting philosophies were not just acceptable, but admirable. As the upload bar reached 100%, Ruby sat back, satisfied. In her mind, she wasn't just a mother anymore. She was a truth teller, a revolutionary parent. Ruby, high on Jody's toxic positivity, was about to proudly display her son's dehumanization for millions to see. Even Dwight, our dog, had more comfortable sleeping arrangements. The internet went ballistic. Ruby's face paled as she scrolled through the comments. YouTubers and TikTokers were accusing her of child abuse. But this is all wrong. They don't understand. Ruby, Kevin suggested, maybe we should take the video down so we don't lose subscribers. No, Ruby snapped. Jody says we need to stand firm in our truth. We can't let the haters win. That one video burned down the 8 Passengers YouTube channel overnight and cost our family 90% of our income. Hundreds of thousands unsubscribed, and brands, once eager to associate with our wholesome family image, couldn't distance themselves fast enough. Overnight, we went from wholesome family influencers to social media pariahs. Ruby seemed oddly defiant regarding the crash and burn of her own channel. People have been asking for years how I've raised such well-behaved children, she declared, chin held high. Now they know. If they can't handle the truth, that's on them. Financial concerns, once a cornerstone of our family's decision-making, now seemed secondary. It was as if Jody's approval had become the only currency that mattered. In my mind, Ruby wasn't just brainwashed. She had become a devoted daughter to a mother figure who seemed to demand nothing less than total obedience. As for me, I was secretly thrilled about our new status as YouTube's most unwanted. Did this mean we'd finally get our lives back? Could I actually eat a meal without it being broadcast to millions? But on the other hand, watching our livelihood circle the drain wasn't exactly cause for celebration. As for Chad, well, he seemed almost amused by the whole thing. Revenge is sweet. Ruby kept the channel up, a ghost of its former self, posting only occasionally. Mainly, though, people were hate-watching 8 Passengers, which still lined our pockets, digging deep into the archives, trawling through 5 years of our lives with a fine-toothed comb, looking for more evidence of Ruby's cruelty. Some videos became infamous. Ruby threatening to behead my youngest sister's stuffed animals, an eye-for-an-eye punishment, after my youngest sister damaged something. I remember that day, the horror in my little sister's eyes, the mocking determination in Ruby's voice. Ruby's rationale seemed to be, you murdered someone else's possession, so how would it feel if we murder yours? Her approach, intended to teach consequences, totally disregarded the emotional capacities of a young kid because for a child of 5, a stuffed animal is more than just a toy. It's a source of comfort, a loyal friend, a crucial coping mechanism for navigating the big, scary world around them. Threatening to guillotine a beloved buddy wasn't just a punishment, it was emotional terrorism. Now, years later, thousands of strangers were revisiting that moment. Ruby posted a vlog where she bragged how she wouldn't bring a packed lunch into school for my youngest sister, who had forgotten hers that day. Ruby explained how the teacher had called her to say she was uncomfortable with my youngest sister being hungry and would like Ruby to drive her lunch over. I told the teacher my daughter is responsible for making her own lunches in the morning, Ruby said in the video. The natural outcome of forgetting your lunch is that you are going to be hungry. Ruby went on to say that she hoped no one shared their lunch with her child that day. She should go hungry in order to learn her lesson. Ruby tried to defend herself afterward, saying the school was a 45-minute drive from her house. There were only 2 hours left of school that day. But that did nothing to calm down the masses. All they'd heard was Ruby's cold contempt for her hungry child. Angry viewers didn't just leave mean comments. They went after what remained of our family's livelihood. People bombarded BYU with calls and emails demanding they fire my dad from his professor job. Someone even started a change.org petition accusing my parents of abuse. Just like that, Ruby and Kevin were canceled. The truth was out there, replayed in countless reaction videos and commentary channels. Ruby and Kevin sent cease and desist letters to content creators who dared call her abusive. They were desperate to silence the criticism, to stuff the genie back in the bottle. Things got real when Child Protective Services showed up at our house. They didn't find any evidence of child abuse, but the damage was done. There was no going back to our picture-perfect online image ever again. Watching all this unfold, I felt conflicted. Part of me was glad others finally saw what I'd known for years. But I also worried if the public shaming would only make Ruby double down on her strict methods. Would the very attention meant to help us end up making things worse? As the backlash intensified, Ruby's rage burned brighter, fueled by a mix of self-righteousness and victimhood. In her mind, she wasn't a controversial figure being held accountable. She was a martyr, crucified for her unwavering dedication to tough love. I am mother. I know best. The very public outcry meant to shake my mother awake was driving her deeper into delusion. And instead of acknowledging her mistakes, Ruby burrowed deeper into the safe space of Jody's poison dart philosophy. Connections became her bunker, a fortress against the onslaught of public condemnation as Jody played her part with calculated precision, never questioning, always supporting, offering comfort to Ruby's wounded ego. She validated Ruby's every action, every decision, and encouraged Ruby to move on to greener pastures. To hell with eight passengers. Why not focus on the Connections classroom, the place where she could truly carry out God's will and share the truth about divine motherhood with Jody at her side? Chapter 23, Obedient Little Drone. Summer rolled around. Ruby, leaning into Jody-approved strictness, declared that her favorite TV shows were banned. No more SpongeBob or Simpsons. In addition, it would be an electronics-free summer. Away when our iPod touches, our gateway to music, apps, and games, locked in a safe in Ruby's closet. I didn't mind so much. I was always more of a reader, but I remember the mixture of disbelief and resignation on everyone's faces as Ruby gathered up our electronics. These were our connections to the outside world, a small taste of normalcy in our household. That summer stretched before us, seemingly endless without our usual digital distractions. I started crocheting and taught my sisters too. But Chad was absolutely livid. How dare Ruby lock away his precious Xbox? With the determination of a master thief and the stealth of a cat burglar, he'd find ways to break into it, liberating the Xbox for clandestine gaming sessions in the dead of night, frantically trying to level up before the house stirred to life. Chad was still in therapy with Jody, but he'd figured out how to play along, how to agree with everything she said while still living by his own rules. I, on the other hand, was earnestly living by Connection's rules, almost addicted to my weekly self-flagellation sessions with Jody. This week, I had black and white thinking 7 times, I reported to Jody proudly, and I caught myself telling myself stories 5 times. You're not getting it yet, Sherry, Jody snapped. This is about more than just tallying thoughts like an obedient little drone. I'm sorry, I mumbled, my voice barely above a whisper, cheeks burning with shame. Stop apologizing. See, this is exactly what I'm talking about, Sherry, she barked, her voice rising. I was completely lost. What does she want from me? Why can't I ever get it right? Look, it's much easier to point out everyone else's distortions than to confront your own, isn't it? If you truly want to grow, you must be willing to look at the ugly parts of your psyche. For clarity, I asked her exactly what kind of ugliness I wasn't seeing. You see how focused you are on getting approval from me, she said. You're still in self-adulation, Sherry. You still need to hear that you're the best, the cleverest. Your areas of weakness are compassion and empathy. But all you seem to do, even now, is look for ways to boost your own ego. Frustration welled up inside me. I had been trying so hard, putting in so much painful introspection, doing my best to correct everyone's distorted thinking. I'd probably lost more friends in the past month than most people do in a lifetime, but I still wasn't getting it right. I was still just a self-absorbed adulator, a garbage person living in complete distortion. That night, I sat at my desk, the soft glow of the lamp illuminating the pages of my journal as I poured my heart out, my pen scratching furiously against the paper. Journal. Jody thinks I am relying too much on external validation. She said I was an obedient little drone focused on getting approval from her and Ruby. Then she said I'm just not understanding compassion and empathy. It was awful. I don't want to be a cold and unfeeling person, which is how she described me. The next week, my heart pounded in my chest as I confessed to Jody how much her words had affected me. "Jody," I said, my voice shaking slightly, "I just wanted to tell you how much it hurt me when you said I was an obedient little drone. But you were right, and I'm very grateful for your honesty. Hearing truth is the only way we can bring about change." "I never said those things, Cherry," she replied calmly. "Excuse me? That's not how I talk. You must have misinterpreted my meaning and then remembered it as fact." "Oh, okay," I said. Tendrils of doubt wrapped themselves around my mind, but Jody seemed so sure, so confident in what she was saying. I guess I must have hallucinated the whole exchange. After the session, I took a look at my journal, flipping to the entry I had written right after last week's call, just to check. And there it was, in black and white. "Obedient little drone. Unempathetic. Not getting it." I stared at the words, a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach. Thoughts like tiny spiders began crawling up my spine. How many other times had she twisted my own memories against me? After that, I became hypervigilant, less focused on finding evidence of my own distorted thinking than on monitoring hers. I zeroed in on the ways she didn't play by her own rules. It became a game, spotting her inconsistencies, slyly pointing them out to her, innocently calling her out on her own lies. During a session, Jody mentioned how a family friend had visited her and brought their young kids. Afterward, Jody noticed the remote control for her curtains was missing. "I just know those kids took that remote to spite me," she said. "How do you know they took the remote?" I asked coolly. "I just knew." "Isn't that an assumption? One of those stories we tell ourselves without facts?" I felt a rush of adrenaline, using Jody's own language to correct her. "Assumptions are different when you have evidence behind them, Cherry," she said. "The evidence being that those kids have a pattern of being vindictive troublemakers." The remote showed up under Jody's couch a week later. The final straw for me was when Jody started talking about how babies are distorted. Those tiny, innocent bundles of joy, with their soft, downy hair and their wide, trusting eyes. According to Jody, they're manipulators who feel entitled for their mothers to come and tend to their every whim. "The problem with society today is that we coddle children," she told me. "We give them everything they want, and then we wonder why they grow up to be selfish and lazy." "But they're just babies, Jody. They can't help it if they cry or need things." Jody's eyes glinted with something dark and unsettling. "Cherry, you think a baby doesn't know how to manipulate, how to get what it wants?" I swallowed hard, my mouth suddenly dry. "I think a baby cries because it needs food or comfort or..." Jody waved her hand dismissively. "A baby cries because it's entitled and it knows someone will come running because it believes that the world revolves around them and their needs. Unless you train it not to be entitled, you're just reinforcing that behavior in them. It's our job as women and mothers to break that cycle of manipulation, to teach children from an early age that they need to earn their blessings. Only then can we hope to create a society free from distortion." Bile rose in my throat. Who is this monster? In my mind's eye, I saw a baby denied the comfort and love she so desperately needed. A baby left to cry it out by her mom, her wails trapped in the emptiness of a dark room. That baby was me. A fire lit in my chest, and as it grew, it burned away the fog. The invisible shackles binding me to Jody disintegrated and turned to ash. No more would I let her poison my mind. It was as if I had been holding my breath, and now I could finally exhale. I told myself then, unequivocally and forevermore, that never again would I trust one single word that came out of that woman's mouth. As I finally started to break free from Jody's hold on me, I began to ask questions. How had I, and so many others, been so vulnerable to being manipulated by someone like Jody? Had the emphasis on obedience that I'd grown up with created a follow-the-leader mentality that made it all too easy to fall under the sway of someone like her, who claimed to have special knowledge and the ability to guide us toward righteousness? The fact that she had been able to so easily convince my family and me of her supposed spiritual authority was worrying. Cults are thought to prey on the vulnerable, the lost, the broken. But here's the thing, they also can ensnare anyone who is simply a human searching for meaning, or people who are in a state of transition in their lives, young adults coming of age, for instance. Intelligence is no defense. My own father, a professor, was shockingly quick to abandon his own judgment in favor of hers. Our dedication to thinking critically and analyzing complex ideas was the very thing that Jody used against us. She twisted our inquiring minds into knots, using our own logic and reason to lead us down a path of self-doubt and self-deception. But it was all a lie, a carefully crafted illusion designed to keep us trapped and compliant. For Ruby, the allure of Jody was more about climbing the ranks and amassing power within the connection system so that one day she could glory in it herself. She had always yearned to lead, and the connection system, with its rigid hierarchy and defined steps toward enlightenment, offered her a tantalizing path to power. Ruby envisioned a future where she, like Jody, would stand at the pinnacle, basking in the adoration of followers, wielding the authority she so deeply craved. But of course, that was never going to happen. Jody, the master manipulator, had no intention of ever sharing her throne. The system she had crafted was designed with a single purpose: to keep herself firmly at the top, surrounded by devoted acolytes who would never quite reach her level. Jody's grip on power was absolute, her control over her followers unshakable. She had cultivated in Ruby and others a desperate need for approval, an insatiable hunger for enlightenment that only Jody could satisfy. It was a brilliantly crafted trap, and Ruby had walked right into it, dragging our family along with her. Chapter 24: The Demon in My Room. Jody's paranoia about her position at the apex of connections was palpable. In a move that revealed both her greed and her fear, Jody demanded that all her certified life coaches sign a new contract. No one could use her teachings or materials as independent life coaches unless they paid her a cut of their earnings. It was a watershed moment. The majority of Jody's followers, finally confronted with the reality of Jody's boundless greed, balked at these demands, seeing the contract for what it was, a desperate attempt to maintain control and monetize every aspect of their hard-earned skills. One by one, people started walking away from connections, choosing their freedom over Jody's increasingly unhinged requirements. Not all of them, though. My mother, in her blind devotion to Jody and her teachings, signed the contract without hesitation, hell-bent on cementing her position as Jody's most loyal disciple. Of course, the narrative spun within the connections bubble was vastly different from reality. We were told that Jody had fired all those disobedient life coaches because they were too distorted to truly understand and implement her teachings. It was a classic example of Jody's gaslighting techniques, rewriting history to paint herself as a victim and the sole arbiter of truth. As I pieced together the real story that these coaches had quit once they saw Jody's true colors, I felt a mix of admiration for their courage and deep, gnawing frustration with my parents. Why couldn't they see what was so obvious to others? I found myself wishing desperately that they had followed suit, that they had walked away. But they didn't. They remained steadfastly loyal to Jody, and by extension to the warped reality she had constructed. Their commitment to this destructive path stirred something within me, a need to assert my own identity, to push back against the suffocating control that had seeped into every aspect of our lives. My rebellion started small, in ways that might seem inconsequential to an outsider but felt monumental to me at the time. One of these small acts of defiance was my friendship with Derek. It started innocently enough, I suppose. A friendship that turned into something else. Derek was high up in the church, a family man and landowner in his late 40s. In May 2021, right after I graduated high school, he asked for my help with social media strategy for his company, offering me a side gig to help him put together videos for YouTube. Having just turned 18, it meant a lot to me that a respected adult like him had singled me out and recognized my skills and talents. After my first meeting with Derek, he couldn't stop singing my praises. "I have to say, Sherry, you really impress me," he said once. "The way you think, the way you see the world, it's refreshing. You're mature way beyond your years." "Oh, I'm just normal," I said, embarrassed. Derek chuckled, shaking his head. "No, Sherry, you're anything but." He asked me to tell him about myself and my family. He seemed intently curious, genuinely interested in getting to know me better. "My family, we don't get along the best," I said with a shrug, and he seemed surprised. "Tell me more," he said. Remembering how Mr. Haymond had been such a positive source of paternal support for me, I decided to open up, just a little. My mom's super involved with a group called Connections. Have you heard of them? Oh, I know Jody Hildebrand. She used to be my neighbor, he said. And I can tell you, she was not very well liked. She wasn't? No, not at all. I can't stand the woman personally. Hearing that from Derek, I knew right then that he was someone I could trust. Someone I could confide in about what was going on at home. A friend. Derek and I fell into a routine, meeting at his office once a week to work on his social media projects. I felt very safe with this regular, middle-aged guy with a happy family and a nice wife he'd been with for years and years. Although sometimes he did say things that felt just slightly off color, remarks bordering on flirtatious, like complimenting my appearance a bit too enthusiastically or letting his gaze linger a moment too long. Each time he made one of those comments, I felt a twinge of unease. But I tried to brush it off, reminding myself of his upstanding reputation. When I finally worked up the courage to tell him to stop telling me how pretty I was, he apologized profusely, almost overdoing it. He assured me it would never happen again. He started doing little things, kind gestures that made me feel seen, cared for. A DoorDash delivery when I was having a tough day, a little shopping trip if I needed something, even if I didn't. One day he told me, his voice low and intense, "I'm the only one who really cares about you, Sherry. You know that, right?" Each time he sent me gifts, I felt a little guilty, pressured somehow. This man who was showing me so much kindness, but for some reason, I wasn't always sure I liked it. One day, I accidentally called him Dad, and that was the first time I saw Derek angry. "I think we're more than that, aren't we?" he said, his face a storm cloud. "I didn't mean to offend you. Please don't be mad." When I eventually told Ruby that I was working with him, she had a fit and forbade me from seeing him any further. "I have a really bad feeling about this guy," she said. "Jody and I don't think it's appropriate for you to be working with him one-on-one like that. Tell him you'll have to stop." "Okay, sure. I'll stop talking to Derek," I lied. I was sick of people telling me what I should do. I was 18 and old enough to make my own decisions. Besides, I knew why they didn't like him. It was because Derek had been Jody's neighbor and probably knew too much. That's why Jody didn't want him in my life. Well, guess what? Jody wasn't the boss of me anymore, and very soon Ruby wouldn't be either, because I was going to college in the fall, which meant I was an adult now and no longer answerable to anyone except God. So I carried on working with Derek behind everyone's backs. And despite the secrecy, it felt nourishing and empowering, having his constant support, someone to lean on. Lord knows, I was about to need it more than ever. Part 4. Mankind Beset by Devils. Chapter 25. Ninth Passenger. About 2 weeks before my freshman semester started, my phone rang while I was hunting for last-minute college supplies. Ruby's name flashed on the screen. Her voice crackled with a frantic energy. "Jody's not well," she blurted out, skipping any pleasantries. "She's being bombarded by the adversary. Her soul is under siege from Satan himself, Sherry. He's trying to silence her truth. So she's moving in with us. We're going to help her get better." I nearly dropped my phone. Wait, what? My mother's unhinged guru was locked in a battle with evil, and her solution was to crash at our place? "Yes, she'll be taking over your room," Ruby continued, as if this were the most natural thing in the world. "It's the biggest of all the kids' rooms, and you're leaving for college soon anyway. I need you to come home right now and clear out, like now, Sherry. She's arriving this afternoon." According to Ruby's breathless explanation, Jody was being plagued by nightmares, visions, and crippling bouts of anxiety, clear symptoms of dark forces seeking to destroy the righteous. Jody, handpicked by demons for destruction, urgently needed protection. And Ruby had decided that protection would be us. "By the way, we can't talk to Paige or that family anymore," Ruby said, her voice bitter. Paige, our family friend, had been one of Jody's biggest supporters and one of her longest-serving life coaches. Until she quit, that is. "What? I like Paige," I protested weakly. "She's nice." "Well, Jody was staying with Paige, and now she's in league with Satan," Mom snapped, as if she were discussing someone who committed a social faux pas rather than joined forces with the ruler of hell. "So that's that. Now hurry up and clear out your bedroom. Jody's arriving this afternoon. Thank goodness she's staying with us now. We'll take good care of her." I drove home, my mind reeling. Was I the only sane person left in this circus? My room was being commandeered by a woman battling demons. My mother had appointed our family as spiritual bodyguards, and I was supposed to just roll with it, pack up my life, and evacuate my room to make way for our mad prophet. I went home, climbed the stairs to my bedroom, and began stuffing belongings into bags. I couldn't believe the epic battle for Jody's redemption would have to take place here, in my teenage sanctuary, amidst my stuffed animals. Glancing over my shoulder every few minutes, I half expected to see Jody standing there, her eyes black and soulless, her mouth twisted into a demonic grin. My childhood nightmares made flesh. Get a grip, Sherry, I thought to myself, even as my heart threatened to pound straight out of my chest. Jody is just a person. A deeply problematic person, yes, but a person nonetheless. If she is suffering, then we probably should help her. I descended the stairs slowly, lugging my bags behind me. As I reached the bottom, I heard the front door open, and there she was. Jody, standing in the foyer in her khaki shorts, her eyes blazing with a feverish intensity, her hair wild, like an Old Testament hermit who'd been wandering in the desert wastes. "Hello, Sherry," she crowed, her voice strangely raspy and raw. "Thank you for offering up your bedroom like a good Samaritan. I appreciate it." "Hello, Jody," I said brightly, forcing an amiable smile. "The room's all yours. Get well soon." I watched Jody sweep past me, headed toward my bedroom like a conquering general, and felt a chill in my bones. This wasn't just a temporary inconvenience. This was the beginning of an occupation. Chapter 26. In Spirit and in Truth. Journal. The house of spirit feels weird with Jody here. Something's going on between her and my parents that we don't know about, and the whole thing is super secretive. I'm trying to spend as much time out of the house as I can. Those few weeks after Jody moved in were a total mind warp, a bizarre, chaotic blur, in which each new day seemed to outweird the last. Jody had taken up residence in my bedroom, and once installed, she never left, lingering like a bad smell, while I was relegated to the couch downstairs, a refugee in my own home. Thank goodness for Derek, the only person I could confide in at the time. He urged me to stay calm as best I could, reminding me that in just a few weeks I'd be a free bird, an independent woman, at college all by myself, away from Ruby and Jody. Even knowing that I was moving out soon, it wasn't easy being in that house. Jody was in a dark place mentally. Night after night, she'd fall into these mysterious trances, not quite seizures, not quite sleep, but something eerily in between. Ruby and Kevin, suddenly embracing a level of mysticism I'd never seen before, would conduct what they called spiritual interventions for her, hushed, intense sessions meant to heal her. Ruby soon decided it was best for her to bunk with Jody so her friend didn't have to suffer through her demonic night terrors alone. I never remembered her being that sympathetic toward me when I was having similar issues as a kid, but this was different, I guess. Apparently, Jody was experiencing incredibly detailed visions. In some, she saw Ruby walking on water alongside Jesus. In others, she envisioned herself riding a massive lion named Charles through the gates of heaven. Charles has since gained something of a cult following on Reddit among those tracking my family's story. All of these fantastical visions were meticulously recorded in a hefty leather binder that Jody referred to as the pen papers. In her delusion, she believed these scribblings would one day be elevated to the status of holy scripture, personally validated by God himself. I felt helpless watching all of this unfold. Dad, who seemed like a shell of his former self, wasn't doing anything to stop it either. I wanted to intervene, to shake him out of this compliance, but I didn't know how. I yearned for my dad to find his backbone, to step up and be the protector he was supposed to be, to shield us somehow, and convince Ruby that Jody needed the kind of care that we simply weren't equipped to give. In the end, he never even tried. Meanwhile, Jody and Ruby hunkered down in their upstairs sanctuary, rarely leaving except for occasional ice cream pilgrimages to Dairy Queen. Their dietary habits were a cardiologist's nightmare, a steady stream of sugar, saturated fat, and fried foods, liberally garnished with Jody's sole contribution to our household, gallons of ranch dressing. Pam, Jody's oldest and dearest friend, high up in connections, was always popping by with a case of soda and a high-pitched, "Hello," that set my teeth on edge. The three of them, Ruby, Jody, and Pam, would hole up in my old bedroom for hours on end. They went boating in Lake Havasu in Arizona for a week and would make little shopping trips down to Mexico, coming back with grocery bags full of pills. When I asked about it, Ruby claimed it was all part of their grand plan to stockpile antibiotics for the end of days. It was as if they'd formed their own exclusive apocalypse collective, and the rest of us were decidedly not on the list. They, like many doomsday preppers in the LDS Church, were obsessed with a book called Visions of Glory, published in 2012. The book, not endorsed by the mainstream LDS Church, was a wild ride of near-death experiences, apocalyptic visions, and doomsday prophecies. It became the basis for many LDS prepper fantasies, feeding into their fears and justifying their extreme preparations. The book's contents ranged from New Age-style spiritual encounters to graphic descriptions of impending disasters, foreign invasions, viral plagues, massive earthquakes devastating the entire United States, including our own Wasatch Front. It was all very trippy and apparently very convincing to Ruby, Jody, and Pam. Strange as it may sound, I don't think I've ever seen Ruby happier than when Jody was living with us, battling entities and riding Charles the Lion. She seemed to have a glow about her. She had always complained about her lack of close female friendships, about the loneliness of motherhood. But now she had her girlies. Jody and Pam had become her ride-or-dies, her squad, her soul sisters. They were the three musketeers of the apocalypse, ready to follow each other literally to the ends of the earth, or at least to the nearest Mexican pharmacy for another antibiotics run. As Ruby, Jody, and Pam grew closer, bonding behind closed doors and sharing whispered conversations, Kevin found himself increasingly on the outside looking in. He was told the upstairs was off limits. He could leave the house when he wanted, but he couldn't return without Ruby's permission. Even access to the kitchen for meals required her approval, and Ruby dictated if and when they were allowed to communicate. New house rules inspired by Jody. Ruby even tried to transfer control of the 8 Passengers YouTube brand to Jody. When our longtime manager Larry raised concerns about her plans, Ruby dismissed his warnings, claiming that this wasn't about money, but about doing God's work. Then they parted ways. Ruby was isolating herself from anyone who might question her increasingly erratic decisions. Relegated to the couch downstairs, I found myself grappling with a cocktail of emotions, frustration, confusion, and a growing sense of displacement. This wasn't just an invasion of privacy. It was a fundamental shift in our family dynamic. I'd grown accustomed to Ruby's boundary pushing over the years, but this, inviting Jody Hildebrandt to reshape our entire household, felt like a point of no return. "Sherry, don't be blind," Ruby would admonish any time I'd timidly inquire if Jody was feeling well enough to go home yet. "Jody is a powerful being, which is why she's under spiritual attack. The least you can do is share your space with her while we fight. Can't you see beyond your entitlement for a moment and think bigger picture?" Ruby imposed a gag order on the entire household, insisting that Jody's presence be kept under wraps, as if we were harboring a fugitive. Here we were, Ruby and Jody preaching truth in their connections videos while concealing the juiciest plot twist of all. Pulling off the charade required some serious smoke and mirrors. Jody was still running her connections Zoom meetings from our house, with Ruby playing sidekick as a senior emotional fitness coach. They'd set up their laptops in separate rooms, backgrounds blurred to maintain the illusion of distance. A slick masterclass in digital deception. When I decided to film a video for my own channel, which was chugging along despite the 8 Passengers' backlash, I had to use my sister's shared room, since my own bedroom was now a shrine to truth and Dairy Queen. I didn't mention a word about Jody, but before I could upload, Ruby swooped in like a hawk. "I need to watch that video before you post it," she said, eyes narrowed. "It's okay, I just talked about getting ready for college in my packing list." "I don't care. I need to review all content shot in this house. We can't risk Jody's voice slipping through in the background." I'm sure that Jody was behind this information blackout. As cracked as her marbles might have been, she still possessed strategic forethought. Moving in with a client/student because she was suffering from mental issues/demonic attack was not the look she was going for publicly. So she had to ensure she was still projecting power and strength, even as her world crumbled around her. For Jody, optics were everything, another thing she and Ruby had in common. "This home situation isn't healthy for you, is it?" Derek said one afternoon, when I'd gone to do some work for him at his office, mainly because I wanted to get out of the house. I shook my head, feeling the tears prick at the corners of my eyes. "No," I whispered, "it's not." During those 2 weeks, Derek could tell I was very stressed. He was intuitive like that, and always seemed to take a close interest in me and how I was feeling. I confided in him, and he always listened, patiently, allowing me to share the pain and confusion of my family life without judgment. Derek studied me intently. "Must be lonely, going through all this on your own." His voice was soft, his eyes full of concern. I shrugged, picking at a loose thread on my sleeve. "I'm used to it." "I wish you had more support, Sherry. Everyone needs someone they can count on." I looked up, surprised by the emotion in his voice. "I've never really had that, to be honest." "Well, now you do." Derek smiled, his hand brushing mine as he reached for his coffee mug. I spent most of the day at Derek's office, and it was sunset by the time I arrived home. The house was eerily quiet. For once, nobody was home. Taking my chance, I made my way upstairs to my room, figuring I'd take advantage of the situation and grab a couple of books. I pushed open the door to my bedroom and looked around, confused. The room was bathed in the soft glow of candles. The air was heavy with the scent of lavender and vanilla wafting from the massage oils on the dresser. I quickly grabbed what I needed and got the hell out of there, feeling like I had just walked into someone else's honeymoon suite. The only thing missing was rose petals on the bed. That night, I couldn't sleep. Maybe it was the fact that the couch was hurting my back, or maybe it was the sense that I'd seen something I wasn't supposed to. I tossed and turned, thoughts swirling. It must have been around 5 a.m. when I heard a creak of footsteps upstairs. I cracked one eye open, just in time to see Ruby tiptoeing out of my room, her hair messy, her cheeks flushed, and her robe hastily tied, heading back to the bedroom she shared with my dad, a strange smile on her face. She looked mischievous. What the hell was going on? Why was Ruby sneaking around in the middle of the night like a teenager trying not to get caught by her parents? Were they really doing candlelit massages in my bedroom? How could this be happening with all of us in the house? In that moment, I felt a bone-deep pity for my father, a once proud and rational man who seemed completely oblivious to what was happening right before his eyes. It was equal parts fascinating and horrific. Two women who preached truth while living lies, who condemned queerness very publicly in their connections videos while embodying it privately, in my room, on my bed, most likely. The next day, I left the house as early as I could and just drove around, going to random places. I couldn't bear to be home, not with all these thoughts in my head. At the mall, I bumped into a couple of neighborhood acquaintances who I knew to be gay, and without giving too much away, casually asked them their thoughts on Jody Hildebrandt, the life coach, and if they had heard of her. "OMG, that woman is so closeted," said one of them, arching an eyebrow. My other friend nodded, adding that oftentimes, the most homophobic people were the ones who were hiding something about themselves. I know my community isn't exactly leading the pride parade when it comes to queer acceptance. A lot of the older folks are still clutching their pearls at the mere mention of it. But times are changing, and the younger generation, myself included, see things a little differently. Personally, I like to remember that Jesus taught us to love everyone. There was a story that kept coming to mind during this time. The story of Jesus speaking with a Samaritan woman at the well. She was an outcast, a sinner, who had been shunned by society, but Jesus looked at her, his eyes full of compassion, of understanding. He spoke to her, not with condemnation, but with love. "You should worship in spirit and in truth," Jesus told her, and those words had always stuck with me. Since Jody moved in, I'd been hearing them louder than ever, playing on a loop in my mind. In spirit and in truth. In spirit and in truth. In spirit and in truth. Truth was a word Jody and Ruby wielded like a weapon. But this story reminded me that truth should always be connected to spirit, the essence of the divine. People thank God all the time, but do they live by God's teachings? Their words might honor God, but do their actions align with the Bible? In spirit and in truth. True truth isn't just quoting scripture while behaving exactly the way you want to when you think no one is looking. That's the opposite of truth. I asked myself, how would I have felt if Ruby and Jody had actually embraced honesty, practiced the authenticity they preached, and told me and the rest of our family about what was really happening between them? And the answer was yes, it would have hurt, but I would have supported them. It would have been preferable to living like this, in this house of lies that I couldn't bear to step foot in anymore. Chapter 27. Dirty, Shameful, Ruined. 2 weeks after Jody moved in, college started, which meant I was finally able to escape. Oh, the joy I felt, fleeing that festering wound of a household. Brigham Young University, the LDS college where I would be majoring in political science, was close by, only 10 minutes' drive up the 89 North Freeway. But still, it felt a million miles away. No more fake smiles and performative laughter to placate my mother and the demon in my bed. Now it was just me, Sherry and her books. Freedom. What a chef's kiss of a feeling. Ruby and Kevin drove me to my college dorm and helped me move in, all caught on camera and later uploaded to 8 passengers, which Ruby was still clinging onto for dear life. Standing there, watching Ruby, all fake smiles and tearful embraces, feign maternal love for me for the camera, filled me with a rage so intense it nearly knocked me off my feet. How could she stand there, pretending to be the perfect mother, waving her beloved eldest goodbye, when I knew all she cared about was that monster in my bedroom at home? As my parents drove away, I stood there, waving, rooted to the spot. I had craved this moment of freedom, yet now that it arrived, I felt strange. I trudged back to my dorm room, each step echoing in the unfamiliar hallway. The space felt cavernous, my meager belongings dwarfed by the emptiness of my roommate's untouched side. Silence pressed in from all sides. For the first time in my life, I was truly alone. No siblings' laughter to punctuate the quiet. No familiar routines to fall back on. Suddenly, a text lit up my phone. "How's your first day of freedom, Sherry?" It was Derek, right on cue. "Want to stop by the office later once you've settled in? I've got you some back-to-school gifts. Remember that North Face jacket you said you wanted?" "Wow, thank you. See you later." I don't remember the drive to his building. I just remember the way my heart was pounding and how my skin felt too tight, like it might split open at any moment. I wasn't sure why I felt so nervous. In hindsight, perhaps it was my intuition trying to tell me something to turn around, go back to my college dorm, and never talk to this middle-aged man again. But I didn't do that, and by the time I arrived, I was gasping for breath, my vision narrowing to a pinpoint. "Sherry, what's wrong?" I heard him say as I stood at his door. "I can't," I choked out, my chest heaving. "I can't breathe. I think I'm having a panic attack." Derek guided me to the couch, his hands gentle on my shoulders. I tried to focus on his voice, on the steady rhythm of his words, but the panic was rising like a tidal wave, threatening to pull me under. "Sherry, listen to me," he said, his voice cutting through the static in my head. "I think skin-to-skin contact will help you calm down. Can I take your shirt off?" I froze, my mind reeling. "No," I thought. "No, no, no." But my mouth wouldn't work, and the words stuck in my throat. I shook my head, tried to push him away, but he was stronger than me, his grip iron tight around my wrists. "Trust me," he murmured, his breath hot against my ear. "Just let me help you, Sherry." And then his hands were on me, rough and insistent, yanking my shirt up, exposing my bra, my skin. I squirmed, I fought, but it was useless. He was bigger than me, stronger than me, and the more I struggled, the more powerless I felt. "See," he said, "it's not so bad. Now just relax for me, be a good girl." His hands roamed over my back, my stomach, snaked up to cut my breasts through the thin fabric of my bra. I felt myself go numb, felt my mind detached from my body, floating up and away until I was looking down at the scene from above. A girl on a couch, a man looming over her, his hands possessive, greedy. This was the first time someone had touched me like this. It couldn't be me. It couldn't be happening. Not to me. "That feels better, doesn't it?" he asked. And I heard myself say yes, heard my voice, small and distant, agreeing with him. I don't know how I made it back to my dorm that night. All I know is that when I finally collapsed onto my bed, I couldn't move, couldn't think, couldn't feel. I laid there for hours, staring at the ceiling as the world went on around me. I heard the laughter, the chatter of my fellow freshmen through the walls, but I was separate, cut off. "I've sinned," I thought. "I've ruined everything." It felt like a punishment, a divine reckoning for all the ways I had failed, all the ways I had fallen short. In my mind, my frozenness, my inability to move was a sign from God, a punishment for my transgressions. This is the Spirit telling me I need to repent, I thought. When I finally managed to drag myself out of bed, to fumble for my phone with numb fingers, I saw the missed calls, the texts from Derek. "Where are you?" he demanded. "Why aren't you answering? Is everything okay?" I stared at the screen, my heart pounding, my mind reeling. "He's worried," I thought guiltily. "I should get back to him so he doesn't get more upset." With trembling fingers, I typed out a response. "I'm okay. How are you?" The reply was instant. "Are you talking to any boys?" I frowned, confused. "No," I typed back. "Good," came the response. "Thank you," I typed, not knowing what else to say. I fell back on my bed again, closed my eyes, and tried to summon up the image of the Samaritan woman at the well, the outcast, the sinner, who had been offered living water, a chance at redemption, but I couldn't find her. All I could see was my own face in the harsh light of judgment. Dirty, shameful, ruined. "Is this who I am now?" I wondered, a dull ache in my chest. "Is this all I'll ever be?" Chapter 28. Grateful. College life introduced me to the peculiar experience of having a non-sibling roommate. To say we were an odd couple would be an understatement. I was the quintessential early bird, greeting the dawn with enthusiasm, while she was a night owl of Olympic proportions. Our schedules were so misaligned that I'd often be crawling into bed just as she was applying her makeup for a night out. And I certainly never felt able to confide in her about what I was going through with Derek and how possessive he had become since what had happened on the first day of school. I had blanked it out, pretended it never happened. I was enjoying a rare moment of normalcy at the campus creamery with a male classmate when my phone buzzed. Derek's name flashed on the screen, and I felt a familiar knot form in my stomach. His text was innocent enough, asking where I was, but when I replied truthfully, he didn't take it well. "Ah, you're with a boy? You don't care about me anymore. That's not very nice." I stared at the words, a mix of confusion and guilt washing over me. Was I doing something wrong by simply hanging out with someone else? Logically, I knew I should keep my distance from Derek, especially after what had happened. But there was a traitorous part of me that clung to the attention he gave me, filling a void I hadn't realized was there. My own father had become a ghost in our family, more present in his absence than in reality. In comparison, Derek's intense focus on me felt validating, even if it came with strings attached. Maybe, I thought, trying to rationalize, it was okay to keep Derek as a friend. After all, he liked me, noticed me. In a world where I often felt invisible, wasn't that worth something? About halfway through my first semester, I went home, partially because I needed to grab a book, but also because I was missing my siblings. I walked through the front door, tentatively calling out, "Hello?" I could hear Ruby and Jody in my bedroom, talking and laughing. Kevin emerged from the backyard. "Hello, sweetie," he said. "You're home. It's good to see you." I wished I could talk to him, tell him what had been going on with Derek. Instead, I shifted uncomfortably under his sad, listless gaze. "Well, I'm just popping in to say hi to everyone," I said. "That's nice. Oh, and I need to grab something for my room." "That won't be possible," he said, more firmly than was necessary. "Why not?" "Jody and Ruby are in there. They're busy." "Busy with what?" I thought. "Braiding each other's hair? Wrestling demon warlords? Debating the merits of Dairy Queen's peanut butter bash versus chocolate chip cookie dough blizzard? Which is it, Dad?" "If you want to go in there, you have to text your mother first and get permission," he said. "Then she can tell you a convenient time to get your book." "Dad, really? Why on earth would I have to schedule a visit to my own bedroom?" "Because that's just the way things are now, Sherry," he said sadly. It was hard for me to believe this was the same person who used to delight me with geological fun facts, impromptu jazz piano sessions, and a childlike enthusiasm for rocks. How quickly minds can become eroded, weather-beaten into blank, featureless expanses. I hated to see him in this state. It was a relief when, after texting Ruby and being allocated 5 minutes to retrieve my book, I could hug my siblings and then swiftly retreat back to school, away from my sad sack of a father and that house where nothing made sense anymore. Thanksgiving was a few weeks away. Would we go to our grandparents like we usually did? Or would this year be different thanks to our new guest? In the early years, our Thanksgivings had followed a predictable pattern, alternating annually between Kevin's parents and Ruby's. These were big, boisterous affairs, each side of the family bringing its own unique flavor to the celebration. At Kevin's parents' house, the sheer number of people was always overwhelming. With all of Kevin's siblings, their spouses, children, and even their children, we'd easily have more than 50 people crammed into the house. It was chaos, but the kind of chaos that comes with warmth and laughter. The downside? Like I mentioned, my grandparents weren't much for cooking, so we often ended up with a spread of store-bought dishes that left much to be desired. Still, the joy of family connection always outweighed the culinary disappointments. Ruby's family gatherings were smaller but no less lively. With about 10 adults and 20-something kids, it was a more manageable chaos. The cooking here was the star of the show, homemade dishes that filled the house with mouth-watering aromas and left us all in a pleasant food coma by the end of the night. As I entered high school, our Thanksgiving traditions began to shift. The rift between Ruby and her parents meant that side of the family was no longer an option. Kevin's parents, advancing in age, found it increasingly difficult to host such large gatherings. Our celebrations became smaller, more intimate. The year before, we'd had one of my favorite Thanksgivings ever, just the eight of us, at our house. Kevin, who had recently gotten into smoking meats, produced a turkey that was nothing short of miraculous. Ruby's homemade rolls filled the house with a comforting, yeasty aroma. I took charge of the mashed potatoes, determined to make them creamy and lump-free. Chad's contribution was unique. He decided to make a giant pot of queso, which seemed like a great idea until it solidified into a cheesy brick within minutes of being served. We teased him mercilessly, but there was genuine affection in our laughter. It became one of those cherished family moments I'd hold on to. I wish we could have just had a repeat of the previous year, but with Jody around, I knew it was unlikely. I pictured her at the head of our dining table, our resident psychic vampire, gorging herself on turkey and my family's lifeblood, my mother crowing by her side, my father silently pushing mashed potatoes around his plate as my siblings and I cast awkward glances at one another. "Hi, Sherry. Just letting you know we're all going to Jody's house for Thanksgiving this year," Ruby relayed in a phone call. "Nope," I blurted. I could have handled Thanksgiving at our home with Jody, but I would have rather gouged out my own eyeballs with a spoon than step foot in Jody's house. Hard pass. Invitation declined. Return to sender. Every cell in my body was telling me to stay away. An awkward silence as Ruby's indignation revved up like a chainsaw. "Did you just say nope?" I can't make it, unfortunately, Mom. Thank you for the invitation." I could almost see the gears turning in Ruby's head as she processed the fact that her eldest daughter was defying her. Error 404, obedient daughter not found. "Sorry, Mom, it's a 4-hour drive to Jody's, and I have a ton of homework I need to do this weekend." A pause while Ruby decided how mad she wanted to be. "Your siblings will be disappointed," she said, and I noticed how she didn't include herself in that sentiment. But I didn't care. Honestly, I would have rather spent Thanksgiving slurping instant ramen alone. In the end, I wound up going to Kevin's parents' house, close by in Ogden, and watching the Andy Griffith Show on TV while eating store-bought snacks and Stouffer's macaroni and cheese. I picked at the remnants of my meal, my eyes darted to the basement door. "Grandpa," I said, setting down my bowl, "can I look at the old family photos, the ones you keep in the basement?" Grandpa's eyes lit up. "Of course, Sherry, I'd be happy to grab them." As he stood up, Grandma called out, "Don't be down there too long, I'm putting the pie in the microwave." Grandpa brought upstairs a folder and set it on a small table, gesturing for me to sit. As he opened it, I was met with the stern gaze of a man with piercing eyes. "Who's that?" I asked, slightly unnerved by the intense stare of the guy in the photo. "That's your great-grandfather," Grandpa said proudly. "An orphan, came over from Germany aged 18, right before the Nazis took over. Landed in New York with his sister, headed straight to Salt Lake City to find him a wife and settle down. He was the first in our family to be baptized into the church." I leaned in, studying the photo. "Why isn't he smiling?" Grandpa chuckled. "People didn't smile in photos back then. Too long of an exposure time." He glanced up at me, his eyes softening. "Sherry, why didn't you want to do Thanksgiving with your family this year?" I bit my lip, considering my words carefully. "Because I wanted to be here with you guys." Grandpa's brow furrowed. Sherry, is everything okay at home? Really okay? Yes, Grandpa, everything's fine, really, I lied. I don't get to see you and Grandma as often as I'd like, that's all. Grandpa studied my face for a long moment, and I held my breath, afraid he'd see through my facade. Finally, he nodded, seemingly satisfied with my answer. Well, we're always happy to have you here, sweetheart, he said, patting my hand. Anytime you want to visit, our door is open. I swallowed hard, fighting back the sudden urge to cry. Thanks, Grandpa. That means a lot. Part of me wished I'd had the courage to tell him the truth, but for now, at least, I could pretend that everything was normal, that I was just a granddaughter enjoying time with her grandparents on a cozy Thanksgiving afternoon. And for that, I was truly grateful. Chapter 29. Jingle Hell. I may have escaped Thanksgiving with Ruby and Jody, but I wasn't out of the woods just yet. Christmas was just around the corner, which would mean another 2 whole weeks sleeping on the couch, my mom and Jody acting like giggling schoolgirls in matching Christmas sweaters, filming their preachy, hateful connections videos in my bedroom in front of the little mural I'd painted, in between daily Dairy Queen runs. The day the semester ended, I showed up at the house. Chad greeted me at the door with a sympathetic look and a whisper. Hey, sis, welcome to hell. The atmosphere in the house was, somehow, even stranger than I remembered.